And so it's a, the story is called A Christmas Ballad for the Captain. That is the name of the story. And the book I'm using is Christmas in My Heart. As I told you many times, there's like 30-some books in the series. Paula's mom and I have always had something in common. We like to read. And so she gave me these books. She gave me these books, and I just, I treasure these books because they came from my mother-in-law, who I love dearly. And so I think of her when I also read the books. And wonderful stories. It's just basically by a guy by the name of Joe Wheeler. He goes around and he tries to keep old stories alive. These old stories were put in Life magazine or Christian Standard, something like that in the 50s, 60s. And he finds these stories and he puts them in the book because they're just wonderful Christmas stories. And this one is A Christmas Ballad for the Captain. It's the author is by a guy by the name of William Lederer. And there's an introduction in here. Joe Wheeler has an introduction. So before I read the book, I like to read the introduction about how this story came about. Joe Wheeler, he writes here, he says, "There's something about war that brings out the unvarnished person that is so often hidden by peacetime glaze. But even in war, one's true colors are often concealed, for a time at least, from those one daily interacts with." He writes, he says, "So many of us in peace or war classify people as being good or bad. Sometimes we are right and sometimes we're not. With reference to the old man and the unholy case, perceptions prove to be something less than reliable." And then he writes about the author. He says, "William J. Lederer, author of such World War II classics as All the Ships at Sea and Ensign O'Toole and Me, and co-author of The Ugly American, remembers a wartime Christmas that was like no other. It was early in the war, and Lederer was an officer on a Navy destroyer. On the return home from the terrible Battle of Anzio, the ship was torpedoed. Lederer wrote down this true story as a Christmas memory of the ship's crew and captain, and then sent copies to those sailors who survived. It was picked up by the popular press and quickly became one of the most beloved stories of the war. Reader's Digest editors featured it as their 1960 Christmas issue story. More recently, it anchored Lederer's A Happy Book of Christmas Stories, published by W.W. Norton in 1981, and it was featured in The Family Circle." How many remember The Family Circle? "The Family Circle 1993 Christmas Treasury. Mr. Lederer is still writing." Now, I don't know how long ago this was written. I don't even know if the guy's still alive, but at this time it says he was still writing. "In fact, when I last spoke to him, he was getting ready to submerge from civilization until his next book was completed. A fascinating Vermont gentleman, he has known personally most of the literary luminaries of the past half century. He concurs with Hemingway, whom he knew well, that an author who lacks kindness will never be able to write stories that are worth reading." So that's the background to this story. So apparently this story is a true story. It actually did happen. So that even makes it more special, I guess. So I am going to read A Christmas Ballad for the Captain, and then we'll spend a few minutes talking about what this means to me anyway, and put a spiritual spin on it. So, A Captain Ballad for the Captain by William J. Lederer. Captain Elias Stark, commanding officer of our destroyer, was a square-shouldered New Hampshire man, as quiet and austere as the granite mountains of his native state. But the only time the enlisted men heard him talk was when they first reported aboard. He would invite them to his cabin for a 1-minute speech of welcome, then question them about their families and note the names and addresses of the sailors' next of kin. That was the way he had first met the unholy K's, Krakow, Kratch, Koenig, and Kelly. They had arrived with a draft of 17 men from the naval prison at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Most of the prison group were bad eggs, but the worst were these four sailors from a small coal mining town in Pennsylvania. They had chests and shoulders like buffaloes, fists like sledgehammers, black stubble beards, and manners to match. They had once been good kids, the mainstays of St. Stephen's Choir in their hometown, but somehow they had gone astray. They seemed to specialize in getting into trouble together as a quartet. All four went into the Navy direct from reform school. Within 6 months, they were in serious trouble again and had been sent to Portsmouth Naval Prison. When they were called to the captain's cabin, they listened to his speech with exaggerated expressions of boredom. Then the old man broke out his record book to note the names and addresses of their next of kin. He looked up inquiringly. Krakow, the leader of the unholy K's, took the initiative. Spreading his tremendous arms, he pulled Kelly, Kratch, and Koenig into a tight circle. "The four of us, sir, ain't got no family. We ain't got parents or wives or relatives." He paused. "All we got is girlfriends, eh, fellas?" Captain Stark simply puffed on his pipe. Patiently, he said, "Well, would you give me your best ladies' names and addresses for our records?" The unholy K's glanced at one another. Krakow said, "Sir, we don't feel like it's an officer's business who our girls are." He stopped as Kelly tugged his sleeve and whispered to him. "Okay," continued Krakow sarcastically. "You want to know who our best girls are? Well, I'll tell you. Mine's Rita Hayworth. Kelly's is Ginger Rogers. Kratch is Lana Turner. And Koenig's is Paulette Goddard. And they all have the same address. Hollywood, sir." "Very well," said the captain. "I will list those names in my records. Thank you, and that'll be all." Well, as soon as the unholy K's got below deck, they began bragging how they had made a fool out of the old man. Kelly started a bawdy song, and Krakow, Kratch, and Koenig joined in. Each man in turn made up a lyric while the other three harmonized. They had splendid voices, and with their choir boy training, they formed a wonderful quartet. They sang four unprintable verses about the captain and why he wanted their girls' addresses. Actually, the captain had a good reason for obtaining personal information about the men. He strongly believed it was his duty to keep their families informed on how they were getting along. So once every 3 months, in blunt New England fashion, he sent a personal note written in a tiny, neat hand to everyone's next of kin. For example, "Dear Madam, your son John is well and as happy as can be expected in North Atlantic gales. If he shaved more often and cleaned his clothes more meticulously, he would be more popular with his division chief. I think highly of him as a gunner's mate, and with luck, you should see him in a few months. You will find he has put on 12 pounds and the extra flesh hangs well on him. Sincerely, Elias Stark, Commander, U.S. Navy." In September, after a year in the combat zone, our destroyer went to the Brooklyn Navy Yard for a 3-week overhaul. Almost all the officers and men went home on furloughs. Only the old man stayed on board the entire time, working alone day and night. No one knew the nature of his apparent urgent business, but whenever we passed his cabin, we saw him hunched over his desk, scratching away with an old-fashioned pen while his cherry wood pipe sat up clouds of blue smoke. We were also puzzled by the scores of parcels in plain wrappers that began coming to the old man before we sailed. It was not until much later that we would find out what they contained. Meanwhile, our destroyer had gone to sea again, protecting convoys across the North Atlantic to England. It was rough work. Icy gales battered us. Ships were torpedoed almost every night. We had little sleep and much physical discomfort. Everyone drooped with fatigue. Tempers became edgy and there were fights. Captain Stark, well, he was constantly on the bridge, smoking his pipe and watching everything carefully. Despite the fact that his clear blue eyes became bloodshot from exhaustion and he stooped a bit from weariness, he remained calm and aloof. If he knew how the unholy Kays were trying to destroy the ship's morale, he never mentioned it. It was their well-rendered ballots that did the dirty work. Everyone was afraid of these four bullies. But when they sang insidious songs about the ship's officers, the crew listened. Their lyrics were so catchy that a song rendered in the after-crew's washroom would be repeated over the ship within a half hour. No officers ever heard the four men sing, but the results of their music were uncomfortably apparent. The Unholy Kays had one song about the hundreds of packages the captain had locked up in the forward peak tank. The lyrics said that the boxes contained silk stockings, cigarettes, whiskey, drugs, and other black market goods the captain was going to sell in England. They depicted the captain becoming a millionaire and retiring to a mansion in New Hampshire as soon as the war was over. The crew began to ask questions. Why should the old man be hiding the parcels? Why had they been delivered with so much secrecy? It was even rumored that the old man was head of a black market cartel, and the cartons contained drugs stolen from the Navy supply depots. But when the crew saw Captain Stark, tall, quiet, dignified, well, they knew in their hearts of hearts that the rumors were impossible. In mid-December, we shoved off from Newfoundland with another convoy. There were 62 ships in the group, many of them tankers filled with high-octane aviation gas. Almost immediately, we ran into a gale. The ships wallowed and floundered among mountainous waves. For nearly a week, we had nothing to eat but sandwiches, and it was absolutely impossible to sleep. On top of this misery, we received an emergency alert and intelligence that the largest Nazi submarine wolf pack ever assembled was shadowing our convoy. After a few days at sea, all grumbling and grousing stopped. We were too weary to do anything but stand watch, straining our eyes and ears for the enemy. Finally, the storm slackened and the submarines closed in. During the beginning of the second week, hardly a night went by without the sky lighting up with explosions of torpedoed ships. Then at sunrise on the 25th of December, as we neared the southwest tip of Ireland, our protection arrived, Royal Navy airplanes. Oh, the seas calmed and we relaxed. For the first time in what had seemed like ages, the men were able to get a hot meal and sleep. All hands except those on watch turned in thankfully, completely exhausted. Suddenly at 9 o'clock on this Christmas morning, the boatswain's mate piped reveille. A wave of grumbling passed over the ship. We had all expected to be able to sleep in unless there was an attack. A few minutes later, Captain Stark's voice came over the loudspeaker. This is the captain speaking, shipmates. I know you're tired and I know you want to sleep, but today is Christmas. There are special surprise packages from your families. They have been unloaded from the forward peak tanks and have been distributed throughout the ship alphabetically. Well, the news exploded through the ship. Men scrambled for their packages. Sailors sat all over the decks, cutting string, tearing paper, wiping away tears, and shouting to shipmates about what they had received. But the four unholy Kays found no presents. They stood together, watching the others sullenly. Christmas, said Koenig. It's only an excuse to get suckers to spend money. Don't show me your new wristwatch, sneered Krakow to a young sailor who proudly held it up. If I need me a new ticker, I'll buy me one. One happy kid, jigging up with a huge box of fudge, said, from my girl. Now I see why the old man wanted her name and address. Hey, said Krakow, grabbing Kelly's arm. Didn't we give the old man our girls' names and addresses? Yeah, said Cratch, beginning to grin slyly. Rita Hayler, Ginger Rogers, Lana Turner, and Paulette Goddard. Well, then how come we didn't get anything? Let's go see the old man. The unholy case, smiling evilly, went to the captain's cabin. Captain Stark, sir, said Krakow with mock respect. We got a complaint. Everybody on this ship got presents from the names and addresses that they gave you. Well, the captain looked at the four men gravely. Well, don't you think that's pretty nice? But we gave you names and addresses, and we didn't get no presents. Oh, you didn't, said the old man slowly. No, sir, everyone but us. That's discrimination, sir. Well, by gum, said the captain, standing up, there are four extra packages. Now, I just wonder... He went to his bunk and pulled a blanket off a pile of parcels. Hey, there's one for me, hollered Kelly, surging forward. Captain Stark stood up to his full 6 feet and blocked the way. Reaching into the bunk, he handed out the packages to the four men, one at a time. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll conduct Yuletide services for all hands. And he went out to the bridge. The unholy Kays ripped the color wrappings. Krakow couldn't open his fast enough and took his sheath knife to slash the ribbon. Inside the fancy box was a pair of knitted woolen gloves. He tried them on his big red hands. Gee, the right size. There was something else in the box. It was a picture of a shapely woman in a low-cut dress. And there was writing on it. Dear Joe Krakow, I knitted these gloves especially for you because you are my best boyfriend in the U.S. Navy. I hope that they'll keep you warm and that you'll have a wonderful Christmas wherever you may be. From your best gal, Rita Hayworth. Joe Krakow felt around his pocket for a handkerchief, but couldn't find one. What did you guys get? He said, sniffling. Me, said Koenig shrilly. I got a wallet, and I got a picture of Paulette Goddard from Paulette Goddard. Kelly received a watch and an autographed picture from Ginger Rogers. And Cratch's present from Lana Turner was a gold fountain pen and a sentimentally inscribed photograph. The Unholy K's shuffled around to the bridge where Captain Stark, his Bible open, stood in front of the microphone. Krakow said, Captain, sir, later, the captain replied bluntly without even turning. He switched on a loudspeaker, announced church services, and read the story of the Nativity to all hands. Below, in the engine room, men listened, and in the chief quarters, in the galley, in the mess compartments, throughout the ship, 250 sailors listened as the old man read the story of Jesus. When he finished, he said he hoped everyone would join him in singing a few carols. Well, the Unholy K's pushed in on the captain. Let us help you, sir, said Krakow urgently. Oh, this is not your type of song, the captain replied. Oh, please, sir, the least we can do is lead the singing. Please, sir, let this be our Christmas present to you. A Christmas present for me, mused the old man. Why, yes, we'd all appreciate having a choir for the occasion. What shall we start with? The four sailors looked at the old man and then down at the photographs and presents clutched tightly under their arms. They gathered around the microphone. Krakow coughed. Then in his deep bass, he boomed, Shipmates, this is Koenig, Kelly, Cratch, and me, Krakow, four no good bums. Today is Christmas, and we want to sing you a special ballad. He paused and wiped his eyes and nose on his shirt sleeve. Krakow then raised his hand like a symphony conductor, and the quartet began to sing. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. The magic of the holy music spread. Everyone on the ship joined in. The helmsman and the officer of the deck put their throats to the Christmas ballad. Even Captain Elias Stark, the granite man from New Hampshire, moved into the quartet, inclined his head, and in reedy tenor swelled the song. Sleep in heavenly peace. Sleep in heavenly peace. The joyous music rose above the noise of the ocean and the destroyer's engines. During the third stanza, an enormous bird soared in front of the low-hanging clouds and landed in the after rigging. It flapped its great wings and made noises as if it, too, were singing our Christmas ballad along with us. My shipmate said it was an albatross. But even though my eyes were filled with tears, I'd swear that it was an angel. Of course, that was many years ago when I was still a kid. But even then, I could recognize an angel when I saw one. As sure as my name is Joe Krakow. That's the story. That's the final story of our Advent season. We're going to put it to bed, and next week we'll get back to regular sermons. Now, let me just say a few words on what this story kind of means to me. As we think about this story that we've just heard, we're struck by the quiet kindness of Captain Elias Stark. Notice he's not a loud man, but he's also not very warm by nature either. He was a captain of a destroyer in World War II, which means he was very serious, 250 men to protect. He was a very disciplined man. And he was a man who had every reason to keep his distance from those four sailors. Those guys were nothing but trouble. Anybody that served in the military will tell you there's troublemakers in the military. They mocked him. They sang cruel songs about him behind his back. They were known as the Unholy K's, and I guess they lived up to that name. And yet the captain responds in a way that no one expects. Notice he doesn't answer insult for insult, does he? Doesn't do that. He doesn't answer cruelty with punishment. How did he answer these four men? Kindness. Kindness. He treated these four guys with dignity. On Christmas, he even made sure that these four guys received Christmas gifts. And let me tell you something, that kindness did something remarkable. It not only reached those four guys, it softened them and it changed them. Changed them, didn't it? Because by the end of the story, these same four men who were mocking the captain were now what? Leading the singing of the Christmas carols. And what do they tell him? We want to give you this as our gift to you. You see, what discipline couldn't do, kindness can do. And my young friend Luke, who's in the West Point, that would be a wonderful thing for you to remember when you become an officer one day. Sometimes kindness works a little bit more than discipline. What punishment couldn't accomplish, grace achieves, even in the military. But you know, this is where the story connects so clearly with Christmas. Because Christmas, you may not understand this, but Christmas is the story of God's kindness to us, to sinners. Now, you may not know this. I hope you do. But the Bible teaches that before we came to Jesus Christ, we were not neutral when it came to God. We're rebellious. We were often hard-hearted. And the Bible tells us that we were what? Enemies of God before we came to Jesus Christ. We were many ways like who? The unholy K's. We were the unholy K's. Far from God and often very hostile toward God. And yet God didn't respond with immediate judgment. He responded with kindness. What does Scripture say? When the goodness and loving kindness of God our Savior appeared, He saved us. Christmas is the appearance of God's kindness. God didn't send someone to lecture us, did He? He didn't send someone to threaten us with punishment, did He? No, He sent His Son, Jesus Christ. And Jesus came gently, and Jesus came humbly. And He came to everyone who didn't deserve Him. And it was in that kind of kindness, the kindness of grace, that will melt the hardest of hearts. Fear doesn't do that. Force doesn't do that. You know what melts hearts? Grace. Grace melts hearts. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but the captain's kindness didn't excuse the unholy Kay's behavior. It transformed it. And in the same way, God's kindness doesn't ignore our sin. You know where our sin is addressed at? Right there. Go ahead and look at it. Our sin is addressed at the cross. At the cross. That's where it's addressed. It's at the cross where Jesus Christ bears our guilt so that mercy can flow freely to us. And let me tell you something, when that kindness reaches our hearts, that's what changes us. And that's when we start to sing a new song. That's when you and I begin to respond with gratitude. And that's when we truly, truly worship, when we understand what happened on that cross. That is why we celebrate Christmas. God's kindness has come near in the person of Jesus Christ. And that kindness of Christ, I'm telling you, it still softens proud hearts, weary hearts, and broken hearts today. And for those of us here today who know that kind of kindness, Christmas also calls you and me to reflect that to other people. To show patience where we might normally show anger. To show grace where we might prefer judgment, to love someone because they first loved us. You know, the unholy K sang a Christmas carol as a gift to the captain. Notice they weren't ordered to sing. Nobody forced them to sing. Why did they sing? Because they were changed. And in the same way, you and I, we offer our song. Not because we have to, but because grace has reached us. As Scripture says, thanks be to God for His inexpressible gift. That, my friends, that's the kindness of Christmas. And it is so powerful that it will melt the hardest of hearts. Well, as we get ready to close, we are, what, today's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 4 days, 4 days from Christmas. Boy, there's people wanting to know what those oranges are about. Oh, I've heard people walking around going, hey, do you know what, oh, it was hilarious. People, I've heard them this morning, hey, what's those oranges for? What are those oranges for? And everybody was asking everybody but me, the only one that probably would know, right? They're walking around asking each other. The only one that asked was John Shortman. Hey, what are those oranges doing up there? That is my gift to you. And I know what you're thinking. Well, that's a crummy gift. He's giving us a lousy orange. My gosh, how pathetic is that? No, I'm serious. That is going to be my gift to you. I'm going to give you an orange. It may seem small, may seem like a simple gift, but do you know that the giving of an orange is a long, long, long ago Christmas tradition? How many of you know that? Did some of you know that? It's a new tradition that I kind of want to start now. Yeah, in earlier generations, an orange was a very rare and a valuable gift. It was often given at Christmas time as a reminder of God's provision. That's why it was given. During the darkest days of winter, its bright color pointed to life, it pointed to joy, and it also pointed to hope. For many Christian families, believe it or not, Receiving an orange at Christmas time was a reminder that even the simplest gifts come from the hand of a gracious God. So today, this orange is meant to remind us of something far greater. Christmas is not about the abundance of things. Christmas is about the abundance of God's grace. And God gave us his greatest gift of all. Not something that we earned, but something that was freely given to us. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. So, as you receive this orange, well, I hope you let it point you to Christ, which is the true, true gift of Christmas. He is the light who came into our darkness. He is the bread of life who satisfies our deepest need. And he is the Savior that was given to each and every one of us. So may this simple gift remind us to give thanks, to rejoice in God's provision, and to rejoice and treasure Jesus Christ above all. Scott, can you help me, please?